Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of August 9th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, good. And we're also happy to be joined again after most of her summertime perambulations around the United States. We have Ms. Mariah Tinger back with us. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good, good. So happy to have you here. Well, no matter where you were this past week, you could not, especially if you're a climate-conscious kind of person, you could not miss the hullabaloo and hype around an article that was published this past Sunday in the New York Times Magazine. The article was called Losing Earth. It was an enormous piece. DR, I think you said it was 30,000 words. It was the entire magazine. I read it online. I didn't look at it actually in the hard copy. But it was just an article entitled Losing Earth. And it pretends to be a, not pretends, I mean, it is a history of the interval from 1979 to 1989, which the author, who is a guy named Nathaniel Rich, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Basically the history of that decade, and it mostly follows a guy named Rafe, what's his last name?
Pomerantz.
Pomerantz, right. Rafe Pomerantz, who sort of awakened to this issue in 1979 and pushed it through the decade. And the name of the article kind of gives it away, Losing Earth. And I think if I could just have the first hot take, I think that the article basically says Exxon's not to blame. Politicians aren't to blame. It's we humans. We blew the chance. The only chance we have when things were best. And let's all surrender. So let's start there. It's a history. It's actually kind of an interesting history. It's a little bit floridly written for my taste. I mean, there's too many internal thoughts of the actors to be a real history. But anyway, I take it you guys might have read it. One of you, do either of you want to give me a cut about what you think? Let's see. Let's start with what's in the article. What did you see in the article? Let's take it a little piece at a time. DR, I'll put you on the spot first. What did the article say or communicate? What was the information that you saw in the article?
Well, when I read the piece, I thought it was a fascinating piece, but my initial reaction was that it was a bit derivative of the book The Heat Is On by Ross Gelbspan, which came out in 1997, and which talked about some of the lead up to the formation of the IPCC and some of the opposition, particularly within the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush administration, to having America lead on the climate crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, initially I was basically saying, I've sort of seen these facts laid out before. At the time I read it, I did not anticipate that it would become as controversial as it certainly has become, to the point where it's become arguably one of the most controversial climate-related articles in modern history, I would think.
Interesting take. Mariah, where are you come down on that?
I mean, full disclosure, I have not read the entire 30,000 word article.
You're very honest. You're a good, honest.
Great depth. I know. I have been off the grid for the past basically 20 days, which has been nice, but also can be challenging, right, when you're trying to stay on top of things. But I did scan it. I did look over it. And while I know the content is not completely parallel, just 1 year ago, July of 2017, the New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells wrote that controversial article, Uninhabitable Earth, for the New York Magazine. And that was controversial. And I'm interested to see your take, DR, on which one was more controversial. I mean, certainly the Wallace Wells article, I think, had some scientific trouble, right? That was one of the biggest hits for that article, is that he, took the 8 degrees Celsius rise in temperatures and hammered that, sort of presenting the bleakest possible scenario for global warming outcomes, and really was, his headings were like doomsday and climate plagues and all these really intense headlines. But it of course caused a whole flurry of criticism for David Wallace Wells, and also, you know, brought up the question of when you pen an article like this, does it just basically deflate anyone's desire to do anything about climate change because there's nothing you can do? It's like we're too far gone.
I think that's one of the knocks that I would have on this article is it's basically a surrender Dorothy kind of message, right? We had this moment in 1979, our human frailties were such that we didn't take action, and then that's where it stops. I mean, there's no sense of what the implication of that message was for the present day. So to your point, Mariah, I mean, I think that it leaves you with this empty feeling of, oh, what's next? What do we do now? We're still humans, and are we going to fail again if we try to address the climate issue? Deanna, is that? Oh, go ahead, Mariah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's exactly the question. Is so that, you know, it's certainly one area I'm interested in learning more about is what is it that motivates people to act? And we know fear is not a long-term motivator. It can be a short-term motivator. And I think that in both of these articles, the common denominator should be or is that we need to move, and we need to move fast, and that anything we do in the direction of climate change should matter. But, you know, it just presents this question, is it too late?
Well, I think to what you were saying, so I read several commentaries of the Losing Earth article. And of course, the last one that I had the chance to read was the Naomi Klein article. And I thought that was quite insightful, because her argument is that it's not the humans. It's in fact during that the Losing Earth article is historically inaccurate or paints the wrong picture. That in fact, all through the 1980s, when it mattered, the fossil fuel industry was opposing action, right? And that they ramped it up during the 1990s. But that, but her bigger point was that the author, Nathaniel Rich, talks about the 80s as some sort of halcyon period for climate momentum, and ignored the fact that in parallel, at the same time, the neoliberal project was reaching a crescendo, right? In 1989 was when the Berlin Wall fell, right? Mm-hmm. It was Reagan and Thatcher, and she quotes Margaret Thatcher saying, "There is no such thing as society, right? We're all individual people." And the neoliberal agenda fights against common action, right? And this is at the time when Francis Fukuyama was declaring the end of history because neoliberalism had triumphed. And her critique was that the article ignores this enormous parallel political momentum that was stymieing the collective effort of climate change. And she also points out, there's one funny quote she has in there of the people that were involved in these decisions in the 1980s were screamingly homogeneous, right? As all white older men who were corporatized, right?
She mentions that in the Rich article, he barely cites women except for as like the hero wives
And that the around the world, there's a lot of people in France and in Germany and in the Caribbean, I mean, the islands of the South Pacific, who are ready to take action, right? There's not this human. In other words, I think what they're taking is Americans as the prototype of humans, and these jokers who are at the top of the political pyramid as the quintessence of what being human is, and they couldn't get their act together because it required long-term vision when the rest of us are sitting around not even able to get involved. So I was quite taken with her analysis. I don't know, maybe you got the... DR, you wrote a whole article about this in Washington Monthly. So tell me, what was your analysis of the whole thing?
See, well, my take on it was that Rich was essentially arguing that 1979 to 1989 was the period where the United States had the opportunity to lead the world. And from that perspective, One year after 1979 was the election of Reagan, who made it explicitly clear, and if you look back at the debates he had with John Anderson and Jimmy Carter, if you look back at his campaign rhetoric, even at the start of his campaign, made it quite clear that he opposed regulation, opposed environmental protection, and was explicitly and nakedly cheerleading for, as Naomi Klein puts it, the neoliberal order.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when the most powerful country in the world, when the country whose leadership would have been required to be the key and the engine to move away from extensive carbon pollution, when the electorate of that country basically decides to ratify the neoliberal vision by virtue of electing and re-electing Reagan, that electorate also blew it. Mm-hmm. And therefore lost Earth. Yeah, and from that perspective, I didn't necessarily view Rich as being off base in his conclusions.
Interesting. So before I say neoliberalism again, let me just, the Wikipedia one sentence, I guess, definition of neoliberalism, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's basically this philosophy that the markets are the solution to everything. A market, an absolutely free market with individual actors is the epitome of human existence. And that's the neoliberals, because of their belief in market fundamentalism, oppose any kind of regulation, oppose collective action on almost anything. They don't like Social Security. They don't like any kind of welfare. They certainly don't like regulation of carbon. But that's the underlying political philosophy that you can trace all the way back to this Friedrich Hayek guy. Yeah, I'm sure you've and this Buckley guy in the 1950s who was a philosopher. So anyway, when we say neoliberalism, that's what basically it means, this sort of politics of the right, of the American right today, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you got,
Maria? It's
an enormous topic. And one question is, well, you go ahead. What were you going to say?
Okay, so I have read This Changes Everything by Naomi Klein, where she talks a ton, of course, about capitalism and how it's so completely destructive to the climate. And she makes great points in that book, and I think they're fascinating. I don't fully know. I mean, I think that there are ways to work within capitalism that would maybe make that where we could pressure. I mean, basically, I think we can't let the public off the hook in the amount of work the public needs to do to move things forward. And yes, sure, capitalism, neoliberalism is maybe part of the problem because we're trying to push away regulations. But, you know, I guess to me, what the antidote to that is people be getting engaged and making their voices heard and getting out and voting and putting people in place that, I don't know, speak louder than that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a deep topic, and I really often go back and forth between, you know, can capitalism work for us, or do we need to completely reinvent the system, and how would you even reinvent the system? What would that look like? And Klein poses a whole different world of what it would look like, valuing a caring economy and the circular economy that we've talked about a lot.
I think you've mentioned the Next System Project, right?
The Next System Project. Yeah, there are a lot of really outstanding ideas out there. It's just hard to know. I mean, should we spend time trying to make those work, or should we?
Right. Well, yeah. I think that since none of us is Karl Marx or anything, the thing I keep thinking to myself is that a vassal, a serf in 1150 AD living in France has no conception of capitalism, right? So we cannot even conceive of a functional system that supplies what we need in a sustainable way that can last for thousands of years as a society. So I don't think it's an embarrassment to say that it's unclear where we're going, right? What kind of system we're going to end up with, and does it evolve out of a capitalist system, right? Does it take we don't know, but I mean, you begin the conversation about that. That's the first place to begin, right?
Well, right, because the capitalism system is sort of premised on the fact that we will have resources the way that we want them for a long time to come, and that when we start running out of resources, right, then the price becomes higher, and that will drive, you know,
something
whatever
else.
Needs to be driven, exactly, you know, more, you know, new innovations or whatever it is. But, you know, it certainly doesn't take into account the effect that, you know, many, many wildfires can have on that system, right? I mean, you know, I have friends in California that live in Yosemite, and they're out of their homes right now. And Yosemite is, I mean, it's not, of course, not a huge money maker generation sort of thing, but right, I mean, Yosemite's closed.
Yeah,
you can't go there right now. Pretty much, you can go to Tioga Pass.
It's the crown jewel of America, right? I mean,
right.
When that burns, what have you got?
It's, right, and you know, that's not necessarily a generation, you know, financial generator. But as we have all of these wildfires hitting the country, and we're directing resources towards putting them out, that, you know, that's a lot of capitalism that's not working right then and there. Or, you know, floods, Houston. I mean, the Week put out a little article that talked about, you know, it's actually surprised the climate change made the front page of the Week, which is, you know, sort of the little summary article of the nation's news.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it was on the front page saying that it's the controversy of Week, the summer of hell happened to us due to climate change. So here we are with climate change in the like forefront of news, which is a big moment, I think, that it's kind of everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's affecting capitalism.
Well, and I mean,
right?
I think, what was it, either Al Gore or Les Gelbspan said, you know, eventually the weather is going to become the news, right? It all comes together. It's one thing, because you can no longer avoid the consequences of warming. I mean, it's
right.
But I mean, but it's an interesting question of why the New York Times would put out such an article. I think you could make a case without having too much aluminum foil on your head, make the case that this is kind of an apology for politicians and Exxon, right? The New York Times has basically said, well, when we had the chance before big oil started to oppose action, we blew it. Right? So there's nobody to blame. Is that a fair analysis? Either one, DR, what do you think? You're more conspiratorial than even I am, but I mean, do you think that there's something behind that, or is this the honest opinion of the New York Times editors?
I don't want to say conspiratorial, but I think that part of the reason for the controversy, and I noticed that right wingers at the Washington Times editorial page seized upon it, is because of the implication, or maybe not even implication, maybe Nathaniel Rich is explicitly stating it, that everyone's to blame.
Mm-hmm.
And the belief that if you argue that everyone is to blame, then therefore you cannot specifically isolate, you know, the fossil fuel industry in terms of legal liability.
Right.
But I think that, you know, and some of the critics, maybe you see this in some of the comment sections of the pieces, some of the people are saying that the New York Times itself is to blame by virtue of the fact that the New York Times ran all those those
mm-hmm.
ads
mm-hmm.
by ExxonMobil denying the science, you know, through their op-ed pages at various points to people to disavow the science and what have you, and that therefore, you know, to say that everyone's to blame, I don't think is to dismiss the major actors. I know there was some sort of symposium at the New York Times where Nathaniel Rich said something to the effect that he believes that the fossil fuel industry is guilty of crimes against humanity. I think the issue is who effectively aided and abetted those crimes. And I think about this controversy in terms of what Pope Francis famously said when Laudato Si' came out, that to change everything, it takes everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it takes everyone to change everything, doesn't it imply that on some level, everyone was responsible?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the other question that comes to mind for me is, what are the implications for activists, people who care about this issue, to see this kind of a message, this sort of, at best, a mixed message going out from the New York Times, a bastion of, you know, claiming to be the free press of our country and the paper of record, to say this kind of stuff. It seems to me the biggest question that is not addressed in the article is, if all that stuff is true that's in the article, how come we're not doing anything now? What are the implications for taking action in 2018 as opposed to 1988, right? And did you, I mean, did either of you see an answer to that, or is that just left open?
I mean, does it go back to sort of what you were saying about that it's just this, you know, it's neoliberalism, it's don't tell me how to live my life, and do we need to, I mean, you know, we wear seatbelts because it keeps us safe, right? So how is it that kind of a rule is acceptable, but limiting climate emissions becomes more challenging? Or, you know,
well, if I could just pull up my old age card. When they wanted to put seatbelts in cars, it was not an easy thing to do. There were battles about that for years. Even putting even as unbelievable as it looks now, there was resistance, and it was going to drive the price of a car up, and everything was going to be bad if you had a seatbelt in your car.
Yeah, remember what happened here in the 80s with that late talk show host Jerry Williams promoting that bill that for several years repealed the law in Massachusetts
to wear a helmet,
wearing seatbelts in cars.
So I guess the point I'd make is that this change, in retrospect, it looks like so obvious, but even at the time, it's a fight. So
I guess, I mean, that's hopeful, right? Yeah. That we can think, okay, well, in 10 or 15 years, we'll look back to maybe 20 years, we'll look back and say, oh, look, remember that fight we had about climate change?
Can you
change
believe and... that people didn't accept this?
Right. That we drove gasoline-powered vehicles? What were we thinking?
Daddy, did you have a gas? Yeah, Sonny, I had a gas power. Anyway, dear listener, this is an enormous article. With a lot of implications that go in multiple directions, right? We barely touch the surface of what to think about it. You can approach it from many different directions. I would say that it is an article. I mean, the good news is Naomi Klein, I think she pointed out that at least the paper of record devoted an entire article to it. So a whole high-profile discussion of climate. Maybe we find a way to take the surrender by the New York Times and turn it into action. Speaking of which, there are two ways that you can do that. You can turn your angst into action. That's a phrase. That's a angst into action. Anyway, next Wednesday on August 15th, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network will be having a webinar, which you can sign up to, and it is on something called Net Zero, which is basically ways to reduce the energy of your home to be net zero, so that all in all, you have you use no energy. It's an interesting topic because it goes across to issues like how are communities going to plan their future development, right? Well, what's required to make a community green? So there'll be a very interesting seminar, webinar. As I say, you can sit in the comfort of your home, eat popcorn, and watch the webinar on your laptop. I'll put up a link so you can sign up to that. The other interesting thing that's coming down the pike is about a month away. 350.org, the famous organization that everyone is aware of, led by climate hero Mr. Bill McKibben, or at least he's still associated with it. I think other people lead it now. Anyway, long and short of it, on September 8th, they're doing one of the classic kind of organizing events that they have done in the past. I do not believe that there is a central national gathering rally. Rather, they're going to be smaller convening of people across the country. You can sign up and have your own climate, I think it's called We Rise is the name of the theme of the event this year. So you can have an event in your own hometown. What you do is you send off pictures to the 350 people. They post them. It's all a great big media event. But it's a good way. Now is the time to start thinking about an event on September 8th. It's only a month away, right? So I'll put up a link to that as well, right? All right, you guys, we're going to end up now. I'll tell our listeners they can check out most of what we discussed at the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. Of course, you can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, all of those things. If you listen to us, please give us a rating. go in, like us, rank us. It helps a lot to push our numbers up in the directory that you're listening to. And so please, that's a good thing to do. If you, it can be your climate action for the day. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, Mariah.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.